compensation. Of course, they need to be compensated, but most importantly, treating those who are ill.
And thank you for being with us, Anthony Hardy, joining us from Madison, Wisconsin, member of the Research Advisory Committee on Gulf War Veterans Illnesses, just came out with its report, and National Secretary and Legislative Chair of Veterans of Modern Warfare. And that does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Phil Dugadu, Sarah Mata, Angelique Comet, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Honey Masood, and Robbie Caron, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nagarin, Peter Curry's our engineers. Democracy Now! Is headed to Sweden next week, to Stockholm on Monday and Tuesday, where we'll be broadcasting and hopefully broadcasting as well from Germany. You can get an update on our website for all the details. If you live in those places, I'd love to meet you, viewers and listeners. DemocracyNow.org is the site to go to. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next, Voices from the Edge with Dave Mazza and a discussion on nuclear proliferation.
KBOO Community Radio is featured inside the 2008 Give Guide. The guide is a tool for simplifying your online holiday giving to Portland nonprofits, including KBOO. And while we welcome all donations, one goal of the Give Guide is to encourage giving by anyone 35 or younger. Plus, there's thank you gifts for everyone who contributes at least $25. Make a secure tax-deductible donation today by visiting our website, kboo.fm, and clicking on the Give Guide image. I'm Andrew Geller, KBOO's Membership Director, and I appreciate your support of our community radio station. Thank you.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of classic concert productions at the Clinton Street Theater, Fridays through December. The series features rare, unreleased concert films with artists including Bob Marley and the Wailers, the Sex Pistols, Neil Young, Led Zeppelin, Grateful Dead, Pink Floyd, and many more. That's classic concert productions taking place at 9:30 most Friday nights through December 19th at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. More information is available at clintonstreettheater.com or by phone 503-238-5588.
Who are the Jewish people? Where did they originate? Shlomo Sand, a professor at Tel Aviv University, deals with this question in a controversial book that's a bestseller in Israel. This is Per Fogring. I will be talking with Professor Sand Friday, December 5th at 10 a.m. on KBOO.
Good morning. This is Dave Mazza, and you're listening to Voices from the Edge. Joanne will be with us next week. She is once again out of town, and we miss her. Well, it's been an interesting week so far. Governor Kulongoski has announced in his budget proposal that Hollywood's more valuable than Oregon seniors and disabled. He's asking for several million to give to the former while saying that we should cut services to the latter. On Monday, Lars Larson questioned Barack Obama's citizenship, and this is something right-wing jocks have been doing on the air now for quite some time, all the way through the campaign, and they just aren't willing to let go. Lars said, as to the president-elect's birth certificate, I'm not satisfied yet either, but I'm not sure whether we're ever going to see the proof that he's constitutionally qualified to have run. So we may have to accept the outcome and just figure that we'll fix it on the next election. Well, I guess fortunately for Lars, reading is not a requirement for his job, since the Obama campaign has actually posted the birth certificate online. It's been reviewed by factcheck.org, who concluded it meets all the requirements the State Department requires for proving U.S. citizenship. And the Hawaii Health Department has also confirmed it. But, you know, Lawrence is a hard man to change his mind on some things. And, of course, on a brighter note, you know, we ended this week, or I should say we started this week, watching Bill Sizemore do the perp walk during the contempt of court hearing. Judge Janice Wilson pointed out that he had been using his foundation's money as a personal piggy bank. So let's just hope Bill made some real interesting new friends while he was down at the Justice Center. Well, on a more serious note, this morning we're going to be talking about something that's been happening on the other side of the globe. As many of you know, last week in Mumbai, India, terrorists attacked two luxury hotels, a train station, cafe, hospital, and other locations, killing 173 people and wounding hundreds more. U.S. and other intelligence sources report a link between the attackers and terrorist groups in Pakistan, indicating that the violence that's been occurring along the Pakistani-Afghan border is now spreading out even more. But another aspect of this is that it marks a really serious blow to the deteriorating situation between a nuclear-armed Pakistan and India, what's been called by some the most dangerous bilateral relationship on the globe. So this morning we're going to be talking with Jacqueline Cabasso, who is Executive Director of the Western States Legal Foundation, an organization that monitors nuclear weapons policy. She's a contributor to the book Nuclear Disorder or Cooperative Security. Last month, she also received the International Peace Bureau's Sean McBride Peace Prize, when we welcome her to the program this morning. Good morning, Jacqueline.
Good morning.
Well, thank you for joining us this morning on what's a very disturbing topic, both in terms of specific events last week and the larger picture in South Asia and elsewhere. But let's start first with Mumbai. What's the significance of Mumbai to the whole tensions around nuclear tensions, I guess we could call them, in Southeast Asia?
Well, I don't know that there is a specific link. The problem is that any time there is an escalation of tensions between India and Pakistan, there is the danger of a military conflict that could escalate to a nuclear exchange. That's the problem, because India and Pakistan have nuclear weapons. They have a long common border. It would take less than 10 minutes for either side to launch a nuclear missile at the other, so that means there's like a 10-minute window of decision-making. the countries have had been at war seriously a number of times since 1947 in the 1999 war, which was also erupted over conflicts in Kashmir. There were at least 13 threats of nuclear use. So the danger is that a military escalation could lead to a nuclear use, and it could spin very quickly out of control. And there's an interview with a former Pakistani general in 2002. He said once, talking about a situation similar to this one in the sense of the sense of rising tensions, he said once the conventional war breaks out, the fog of war sets in. And during war, you have deceptions, you have misperceptions, you have communication breakdowns, things get heated up. And actually, that is more broadly applicable to any conflict in the world now involving countries with nuclear weapons.
Right. No one actually ever, I think, starts off thinking that they're going to be utilizing, you know, weapons of mass destruction or using everything in their arsenal when the conflict begins.
That's right. And that's something that actually is not commonly understood very well. A nuclear use will not be the first act in a war, but in the wars of the future that we might be looking at, wars over resources between countries that have nuclear weapons, that's the kind of escalation situation that we're thinking about, or that we're looking at.
Well, you know, we hear a lot about in the press about Pakistan having nuclear weapons and the fact that is, you know, it's a state that seems to be starting to really unravel. How concerned should we be about that situation? I mean, how, in terms of the nuclear weapons?
Well, I think it is true that Pakistan seems to be unraveling. And that certainly is a source of concern. But I think the way we frame this, the concern is what's kind of key. A report came out yesterday from the government called World at War. World at Risk, which is a very disturbing report, which projects that there is going to be a terrorist use of either nuclear or biological weapons somewhere in the world in the next 5 years, and puts out a rather, I think, regressive set of recommendations. But it identifies Pakistan as kind of the crossroads for all of this. So if we frame Pakistan as a dangerous, radical,
disintegrating state.
Yeah. Then we are certainly not giving credit to the 1.2 billion ordinary people who live there, most of whom are not terrorists or extremists.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we really need to think about, as a global community, we really need to think about engaging with Pakistan in a collective search for common security and for regional security. Certainly India has a big role to play in that. The United States has a big role to play in that because we have very close ties with India and with Pakistan, actually. So I think that it needs to be viewed as an issue of global concern, as an issue of regional concern, and it needs to be approached in a very sober, level-headed way. And I think that one thing the United States could do is to, under this new administration, is to reject the model of the global war on terror that we initiated after September 11th, 2001, which, in my opinion, has only led to more terrorism and made everyone less secure, and instead look to a model of a criminal justice model, a police model, where, for example, what should be done in the current case is that there should be a very careful, sober, thorough investigation. Evidence should be collected. Suspects should be, arrested and should be brought to justice through, legitimate trials. And, if found guilty, punished accordingly. That is very different from a war on terror, where these acts are treated as acts of war, and more innocent civilians are killed and punished as a result. I mean, something that is not being widely reported, but it did appear in the Las Vegas Review-Journal recently, is that the U.S. is actually operating drone airplanes in parts of Pakistan, which are dropping bombs and killing civilians every day.
And if we're, so far at any rate, we don't have a lot of information to work on since he hasn't taken office yet, but based on his comments, it seems that Barack Obama has at least expressed a willingness to continue this intrusion into Pakistan in pursuit of the war of terror on terror.
Yeah, well, it is very worrying. Also, there's a very close connection between Afghanistan and Pakistan, and between Afghanistan and Kashmir, actually. And it's very worrying that in his campaign, Obama, promised repeatedly to expand the war in Afghanistan, he talked about bombing Pakistan, as you say. So, to give him the benefit of the doubt, which I keep trying to do, because I have more and more doubts, he also talks about diplomacy, about cooperation, about multilateralism, about the importance of the United Nations, and so on. So
mm-hmm.
He's kind of been sending mixed signals. One of the negative mixed signals is the appointment of Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. She has not exactly been dovish on these issues, but.
And in fact, we'll want to talk about it a little more, but I just want to remind listeners that they are listening to KBRO. This is Voices from the Edge. I'm Dave Mazin. I'm talking this morning with Jacqueline Basso, who is the executive director of the Western States Legal Foundation. We're talking about the, situation in South Asia as it pertains to the nuclear threat, as well as the bigger picture of nuclear proliferation. If you want to join us in this conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. And as always, we encourage our listeners who have never picked up the phone to join us in a conversation to do so. We want to hear from you, hear what you think, and give you a chance to ask questions of our guest. So, Jacqueline, you know, you mentioned Hillary Clinton. The Clintons actually, I mean, I don't want to lump her in with her husband, but the Clinton administration actually, you know, was involved. The problem of nuclear proliferation in South Asia, the Clinton administration actually was sort of supportive of allowing India to build up their nuclear resources, weren't they?
They were. After the Indian and Pakistani nuclear tests in 1998, there was an initial reaction of placing economic sanctions, which were very quickly lifted, and relations were normalized. Actually, it is the Clinton administration, in my opinion, really, really blew the historic opportunity that appeared with the end of the Cold War to move definitively to delegitimize nuclear weapons and begin to negotiate their elimination. Instead of that, time after time, Clinton administration reaffirmed the Cold War policies, reaffirmed in 1997 the threatened first use of nuclear weapons as the cornerstone of U.S. national security policy, expanded the role of nuclear weapons to, quote-unquote, deter not only nuclear but also chemical and biological weapons, which was one way of lowering the threshold to nuclear weapons use, put in place this massive stockpile stewardship program, which is a investment of many billions of dollars in modernizing the nuclear weapons research and production complex, and also signed legislation making it national policy to deploy a national missile defense system as soon as it was technologically feasible. So in all of those ways and more, you know, I mean, think about it. I mean, we look back now, and those of us who remember, who are old enough to remember the Cold War, the Cold War was the justification, we were told, for mutually assured destruction, for having these huge nuclear arsenals. Who could have imagined? I mean, I was an activist already. I could not, if you had told me, imagine that the Soviet Union would disappear overnight. Inconceivable, right?
Right.
It happened. And then everybody thought, well, we didn't have a nuclear war. We can forget about it and move on with other things. But nuclear weapons didn't go away. The nuclear weapons establishment came up with new justifications to perpetuate itself. The Clinton administration came up with new justifications. They expanded this so-called counter-proliferation program, which is what I was alluding to earlier. And actually, the nuclear weapons budget went up. By the end of the Clinton administration, it was like almost 1.5 times bigger than it was during the Cold War years.
Wow.
So that set the stage then for the Bush and, you know, his preventive war policy and all of those things. And then most recently, I wanted to get back to this, the U.S. Just ratified this extremely dangerous nuclear sharing deal with India, which I'm sorry to say both, well, all three, Clinton, Biden, and Obama, all voted for very recently. And this is a deal that where the U.S. provides India with civilian nuclear technology. India is not a party to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, so this is a violation of the nuclear sharing restrictions in the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Because India is not a party to the NPT, its military nuclear program is not under any kind of International Atomic Energy Agency safeguards, and this program will allow India, if it wants to divert its existing civilian nuclear facilities to its military program to produce more fissile materials for bombs.
which is precisely what we really need in that part of the world, as a, you know, considering the tensions.
Exactly.
I want to go into this in more detail, but we do have some callers who've been waiting. So let's go to the phone lines, where we have Scott on the line. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning. I have a question for your guest. Go for it.
I don't want to muddy the waters with an additional area, but I will. Tibet, which is a long simmering, 50 years. A Dalai Lama just had a meeting in Dharamsala with thousands of people from around the world, Tibetans and non-Tibetans, about the future. And they're considering giving up his middle path, which is to have China run Tibet, but Tibet be an autonomous state, and may actually go towards a true independence movement. Now, why I bring that up is because Jammu Kashmir, the Punjab area, that is open, and the Tibetans, which are often defiant of the Chinese government because of the occupation, you know, certainly could help in funneling weapons or any profiteer. And so perhaps you could mention what you think maybe Tibet might have to do with this in the future.
Thanks, Scott.
You know, I'm really not very well informed about the Tibetan issue, so I'd be very reluctant to comment on it. Sounds like you know quite a bit about it.
Yeah, I would say at the very least, it sounds, as Scott mentioned, that, you know, it's just adding a little more heat into an area that's already overheated, particularly that flashpoint in Kashmir.
Yes, of course. And also remember that, you know, China is a nuclear weapon.
Is also a nuclear weapon. Well, we have another caller, so let's go back to the phone lines, where we have Barth on the line. Good morning, Barth.
Good morning. Sorry to break your frequent caller rule, but this is a hot button for me. The initial reports say that the remaining shooter from the Mumbai massacre states that he was trained directly by Pakistani military people in Pakistan, and that there were comments on Amy Goodman's show that the intelligence agency that pretty much runs Pakistan has been funneling lots of energy into this direction of unsettling, if you will, the states of India. That's one thing. The other thing that I don't know if you touched on while I was transitioning from my radio to the phone was in the little spat in the Georgia where the Russians I think overreacted but properly reacted to the overt actions of the Georgian government. The Russians were worried about the Americans living up to their claim of backing up Georgia and supporting them, and that they brought nuclear truck-launched missiles, SS-1s, into the country of Georgia and set them up so that there wouldn't be any question about Americans launching supportive military raids, not to say that we would have launched nuclear weapons in that area, but not to be supportive militarily from elsewhere in Europe to the Georgians. They let it be known that if there was any strong American military response, which the Russian army would not have been able to deal with, that they would have upped the ante pretty quickly. And I'd like your guests to comment on that, and I'll just take my answers off the air. Thanks.
Thank you, Barth.
Okay, well, with respect to the first comment about the potential relationship between the Mumbai terrorists and the Pakistani government, I've been reading everything I get my hands on about that, and there's infinite speculation, and nobody really knows. So I just want to caution people to follow the advice of our colleagues, people like me who work in this field, to not jump to any conclusions and to wait for to call for a very thorough, careful, sober investigation.
A smoking gun, even though that's a terrible metaphor for situation like
because,
that.
Because, I mean, think of what we're hearing is we're trying to speculate based on reports of confessions of the only surviving gunman. Now, how many steps in the telephone chain is that, you know? That's one thing. It's a very complicated situation. It has long historical roots. We can just say with great assurity that there are very serious historical tensions between India and Pakistan, which have been exacerbated by this massacre. On the second question, I actually had not heard that Russia had moved tactical nuclear weapons into Georgia, but the caller is correct that the incident was initiated by Georgia and not by Russia. The press reports we were getting here were completely misleading initially. In fact, recently the New York Times even acknowledged that, which was kind of amazing. But the reports we were getting from Europe were to the opposite. The United States has been very much involved with backing up and supporting the Georgians. But there's a larger point which is illustrated here, which is that Russia has been talking increasingly about the need for what they call strategic stability in connection with any future nuclear arms reductions. And what they mean is that the United States now has overwhelming conventional military superiority, and the Russians feel that they need nuclear weapons to counter that. This is particularly the case because of the U.S. plans to place missile defense interceptors in Poland and radars in the Czech Republic, which Russia takes as a direct threat. And so they have begun some nuclear weapons modernization programs. They are talking about redeploying some nuclear-carrying submarines and so on for the first time in a number of years. And so this illustrates another sort of nest of complicated issues which we have to deal with when we're talking about nuclear weapons, which is the relationship between conventional and nuclear weapons. When Gorbachev and Reagan met in Reykjavik and talked about getting rid of nuclear weapons, one of Reagan's, and Gorbachev has recently written about this, one of Reagan's demands or concerns was that there was, at that time, overwhelming Soviet conventional superiority. And so as a result, Soviet Union, negotiated the Reduction of Conventional Forces in Europe treaty. And then it was Reagan who would not give up Star Wars, which was the deal breaker in that case. Now we have a reverse situation where the United States has this overwhelming military, conventional military superiority, which is serving as a rationale for whatever their various agendas are for Russia and China to modernize their nuclear forces. So we have to come to grips with that. It's a really difficult problem, because when Obama says, as he did just the other day, I will maintain the world's strongest military, and he's also saying I will lead the way to a world without nuclear weapons, you know, those things are actually related, and they're not compatible.
Right. Well, you're listening to KBLO. This is Dave Mazza, and I'm talking this morning with Jacqueline Cabasso, who is the executive director of the Western States Legal Foundation, a group that monitors the situation regarding nuclear weapons. And we're talking in general about the problem of nuclear proliferation, but also as it pertains to the increasingly tense situation between Pakistan and India. And if you want to join us in that conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. And as always, while we love to hear from our regular callers, we'd also love to hear from you folks who have never picked up the phone before to make a comment or ask a question. So join us in the conversation. And before we go back to Jacqueline, I do have one short announcement here to make, and it's about an event coming up actually today. It's Vision into Action Coalition event, Food, Networking, Music, and Action. It's Thursday, today, December 4th, 6 to 9 p.m. at Disjecta. I always have trouble with that name, Disjecta. 8371 North Interstate. And the Vision into Action Coalition, a broad-based community-led alliance of organizations, businesses, governments, and individuals, are acting collectively to ensure implementation of Portland's community vision. They'll be hosting an event on today and help make your community's vision a reality. Network with other coalition partners and friends. Learn how people are using the vision to advocate for change. get involved in VIA actions and projects currently underway, find out what resources and partners and resource partners and friends bring to the coalition, share the resources that you bring to the coalition, and help shape the future coalition work. And let's see, if you have more questions about this, you can contact Stephanie D. Stevens, who is Program Manager, Vision into Action at the Portland Planning Bureau. The number there is 503-823-9588, or you can email at stephanie.stevens, and that's S-T-E-P-H-E-N-S, at ci.portland.or.us. And so it's just a way to keep nurturing our local culture and environment here. Well, Jacqueline, I wanted to get back. We were talking a bit there before the callers about Clinton administration, and you had started to talk about Hillary Clinton, and let's talk about that. With she's going to be the Secretary of State point person on dealing with things like the potential for conflict between India and Pakistan and elsewhere, countries that have nuclear weapons. Should we feel more comfortable with her? Is she in a better place than her president husband was?
I haven't seen any evidence to support that, I'm sorry to say. As I said, she was a supporter of this nuclear sharing deal that I mentioned. And one part of that nuclear sharing deal that didn't get very much attention in this country is the fact that it was actually tied with a number of other deals having to do with agribusiness, conventional military sales, other kinds of corporate deals, all of which serve to benefit, you know, the elites in India and the United States and do nothing really for the vast majority of the people in India. And it's worth mentioning that, for example, in Mumbai, 60% of the population lives in extreme poverty. So I would say that from everything I know about Hillary Clinton, she tends to associate with or be part of those elites who serve to benefit from these kinds of deals. I'm not sure that her interests are really with the well-being of the people. I hope I'm wrong about that.
You weren't taken in by her, you know, downing shots of bourbon in, what was it, Pennsylvania, when she was hanging out in that bar?
Well, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, she's a mixed bag. You know, on health care, her inclinations on universal health care seemed to be very genuine, and that certainly is something that is a human right and a human need. But in any case, I was also going to say that she has been a very big supporter of Israel's government, and India is Israel's biggest buyer of conventional weapons. So there is a strategic relationship between Israel and India, as well as a strategic relationship between the United States and India. So there are, I don't find a lot of comfort in that particular strategic relationship and its implications for the region.
Understandable. Well, we have another caller waiting, so let's go back to the phone line where we have David on the line. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Dave, and is it Jacqueline?
Yes, it is.
Yes. I just wanted to point out a couple of things that maybe should be made more obvious or exposed that are more of the philosophical underpinnings of these types of dealings, and that is that it has been many decades, many centuries now, really, looking back on human history, but the politics of confrontation and the acts of war and the threats of war are failed politics. When we look at the broad spectrum of human history and look at our own kind and our activities together, it is a form of failed politics. It is not solving problems. It is generating problems. That's number one. And the thing that complicates that is that the force and power of modern weapons is so destructive now that the usual failed politics of war and the confrontation or escalation process results in the threats of massive destruction, such that non-combatant countries and non-combatant peoples will be greatly affected. So it's ultimately a very failed process, and it should be exposed as such. It's not a process of success, and even for the nationalists, it has to be. They have to wake up and realize it's a process of destruction. The other thing is that the business of dealing with nuclear technology and making deals to send arms to other countries and get money for this, I assume they're getting money for this, is bad business. That's bad capitalism, bad business. It's like the business of mobsters or something. It's just bad business, and it should be publicized as such in the press, if they were to be honest, that this is not legitimate business. It's bad business. Selling missiles is bad business. Right. So that's what I wanted to say.
Thank you, David. Well, you know, and he brings up one point about the bad business is American corporations have also been deeply involved, haven't they, Jacqueline, with helping, for example, India develop their nuclear capabilities. I think, didn't IBM share or sell like supercomputers to India at one point?
Yeah, I think that's right. India's nuclear weapons program originated with the Atoms for Peace program, with support from the United States and Canada. If I could comment on what the caller said,
please do.
I mean, that was all of that very well said. I completely agree with you. And the way that the language that I use to talk about it is. Redefining the need to redefine security. We are hammered with this notion of national security at any price, and this has been really exacerbated during the Bush administration. But, you know, national security is paramount, and we will bring about national security through ever-increasing, overwhelming military might. One of the most dangerous and underreported programs underway now is something called prompt global strike capability. The Air Force is really keen on developing conventional intercontinental ballistic missiles. In other words, weapons that could carry missiles that could carry conventional warheads anywhere on Earth to strike in an hour or less. They lament that they only have the capability now to deliver nuclear weapons in that manner. And this is another incredibly destabilizing factor, because if you are on the receiving end of one of those missiles, you don't know what it's carrying, and if you have a nuclear capability, you will use it. China actually now is concerned about the combination of this prompt conventional strike capability and the missile defense, so-called missile defense interceptors, which actually operate more like a shield with the offensive weapon being the sword. So as the caller rightly says, it's failed politics. It makes violence begets violence. It kind of goes back to the basics. But the stakes are so high now. And so I ask the question, you know, are you more secure? Are we more secure now? Are people in this country more secure because of these policies? And I think the answer is clearly not. And so we have to develop a new framework for thinking about security that is universal, that is collective, that is based on providing for the security of each individual everywhere. And that would be the individual in starting with her home and her family and her community and her environment and her job and so on. And in this, ask the question, how do you, and that kind of security applies to everyone everywhere, and how do you provide for that kind of security? You can't, it doesn't come out of the barrel of a gun. It comes out of food, clean water, sanitary systems, medical care, education, and so on. And, you know, we can make that choice. We have to make that choice.
Well, so, right, I agree, and I want to,
because this militarism is, it's as the caller pointed out, with
with the weaponry that we have now, it's unsustainable. It will lead to the end if we keep going this way.
And that's the end with a capital E, not just that, you know, we become a failed state. Well, I want to come back to how much opportunities we're going to have to pursue that sort of vision based on where we see the new administration on things like helping rein in nuclear proliferation. But first, I have to remind folks that they are listening to KBOO. I'm Dave Mazza, and I'm talking with Jacqueline Cabasso, who is executive director of the Western States Legal Foundation, a group that monitors that. And if you want to join us in the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. And I have Karen on the line. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning. Since both of you seem to have some pretty serious reservations about Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, I'm wondering if you'd be willing to name a person or two that you'd rather see as Secretary of State. And that's my question.
That's a good
one. Any candidates there, Jacqueline?
Yeah, Barbara Lee, my representative. She would be great.
And for folks who may not be familiar with Barbara Lee, what would be her qualifications? What is she, you know, this issue?
The thing that she is best known for is her lone vote, September 14th, 2001, against a blank check for war.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, she turned out to be right. But she actually has extensive international experience. She's traveled a lot. She was the protege of Ron Dellums, for those who remember Ron Dellums, who was an amazing man, a pacifist who rose to be the head of the chair of the House Armed Services Committee in the Clinton administration, and always a leading voice for peace, demilitarization, author of alternative military budgets year after year and things like that. So she worked for him, and then she came up under his tutelage and then ran for his seat when he retired. So I think she is eminently qualified, and her positions on absolutely everything have been excellent. Her positions are, you know, I mean, the person I was going to say at first was Dennis Kucinich, who is probably better known to your listeners, I would guess.
We have a lot of Barbara Lee fans here, though.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to defer to your judgment on that. And before we pick up the next question, I do have a couple of announcements I do need to make. And let folks know, coming up this morning on KBOO, at 9, it's Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know, hosted by Teresa Mitchell. At 9:30, host Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher interviews journalist Harmon Leon, who is known for infiltrating and exposing the weird and wonderful subcultures of America. His most recent book is The American Dream. At 10 on The Recovery Zone, Stephanie Potter asks, can community trump economic hard times? With guests from Northeast Portland's newly forming Columbia Eco Village. At 10:30 on Art Focus, host Ava Lake interviews the artist Catherine Ace. Ace is known for making still lifes which use both paint and collage techniques. At 11, it's Air Cascadia with host Chris Andre and Liam Delta. And at 11:15 on Flashpoints, financial analyst Catherine Austin Fitz has the Community Business Report. We'll hear from an eyewitness to Israeli settler and military violence against Palestinians in the West Bank. And we'll get an update on the case of death row prisoner Troy Anthony Davis. Also remember, to hear this interview or get more info on Voices from the Edge, you can go to the KBOO website. We'll be having more coming out on that website every day, but you know, you can log in, listen to the podcast, or just play it over and over again if you really like the sound of our voices. But one other quick announcement here, too, and this is for next week. Next Thursday, December 11th at 6:30 p.m., City Repair Project is pleased to announce that the initial informational meeting of site communities who will be participating in this year's Village Building Convergence will be held at 6:30 p.m. next Thursday. All interested members of any community in or outside of Portland are encouraged to attend. Bring your ideas and visions for a better world and share them with dozens of other communities as we get ready to change the world together. The meeting will be held at City Repair's headquarters, located at the former Women's Temple at 3125 East Burnside. The dates for this year's Village Building Convergence have been shifted into June this year. Instead of being held in late May, the VBC will be held from Friday, June 5th to Sunday, June 14th. For more information, you can go to cityrepair.org or call 503-235-8946. Well, Jacqueline, since we're talking about the current administration, what's been your take? I haven't been picking up much. There didn't seem to be much discussion both during the campaign and during this transition period, specifically around nuclear proliferation issues. What's your take on where they are? And then following that, you know, what should be like the top five things they need to be looking at to deal with this issue?
Okay, let me ask you how you are using the word nuclear proliferation.
Well, let's just say I think we should talk about the whole issue of the problem of nuclear weapons.
Okay.
And both in terms of our own stockpiling and continuing to develop them, as well as things like the U.S.-India deal and our other actions around the world that lead to proliferation.
Okay. Well, actually, Obama, in his campaign and now on his transition website, has a fair amount about nuclear weapons. He has said repeatedly, "I will lead the way to a world without nuclear weapons." But then the next sentence is, "But as long as nuclear weapons exist, we will maintain a robust nuclear deterrent." And that is a very problematic sentence, because a robust nuclear deterrent actually includes a giant military-industrial complex,
right,
and a set of very entrenched policies. And that statement is now being made by Gates, Secretary of Defense Gates, who is being kept on, which I'm not too happy about.
I was going to say, maybe folks, I think, know Gates in relation to the CIA, but do we have any sense, is he extremely hawkish on the nuclear issues?
Well, he has said recently as long as, someday we should get rid of nuclear weapons, but they are an essential component of our national security, and as long as other countries have nuclear weapons, we must have nuclear weapons, and in order for our nuclear weapons to be safe, secure, and reliable, we need to build new nuclear weapons. So he is advocating for the so-called reliable replacement warhead, which is a program that so far is only in research and development, but to build new nuclear weapons, basically. So that's part of it. Obama has made promises to keep the U.S. commitment under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, but when you look into the specifics of that, he's really focused on other countries not getting nuclear weapons and not on keeping the U.S. commitments under the NPT, the U.S. legal obligation to negotiate in good faith the end of the arms race at an early date and the elimination of nuclear weapons. He has pledged to work with Russia to take U.S. and Russian ballistic missiles off hair trigger alert, to dramatically reduce the stockpiles of U.S. nuclear weapons, and to seek a global ban on the production of fissile materials for weapons. Well, those are kind of standard arms control measures that have been off the agenda during the Bush administration, so it's good that they're back on the agenda. But again, when I look at those promises in connection with the people who so far he's identified as his cabinet members, and a very serious push now, push back from the nuclear weapons establishment to go in a different direction. For example, the Air Force has, just 2 weeks before the election, the Air Force released this 150-page roadmap for reinvigorating the Air Force nuclear enterprise in the 21st century, which is basically a step-by-step PR campaign. It says nuclear forces continue to represent the ultimate deterrence capability that supports U.S. national security. Because of their immense destructive power, nuclear weapons, as recognized in the 2006 National Security Strategy, deter in a way that simply cannot be duplicated by other weapons. In short, we will continue to fortify current operations, develop our people, and sustain and modernize current capabilities. And then another Air Force report from September says this, and listen to this. This is really chilling because the word deterrence is thrown around a lot. But what does it actually mean? This is what the Air Force says. Though our consistent goal has been to avoid actual weapons use, the nuclear deterrent is used every day by assuring friends and allies, dissuading opponents from seeking peer capabilities to the United States, deterring attacks on the United States and its allies from potential adversaries, and providing the potential to defeat adversaries if deterrence fails. The quality and credibility of U.S. nuclear forces and the new triad forces more broadly are critical to an effective deterrent. Well, the new triad is the underpinning for all of the nuclear weapons budget requests and for the nuclear posture review and for all subsequent policy documents since 2001. And what it is they took the old strategic triad, and this is actually a very useful way for understanding U.S. foreign policy, foreign military policy. The old strategic triad consists of intercontinental ballistic missiles, ground-launched, and there are about 500 missile silos spread around the Midwest with Minuteman III's. Submarine-launched ballistic missiles, those are Trident submarines, and those are still patrolling the oceans at the same rate as they were during the Cold War, and strategic bombers. So those systems were moved into one leg of a new strategic triad, so-called, and combined with conventional forces. In other words, the traditional firewall between nuclear and conventional weapons was removed, and so we now have this kind of seamless spectrum of offensive weapons capability, including nuclear and conventional weapons of all kinds. The second leg is the so-called defenses, and I alluded to this earlier. That would be the missile defenses, the national missile defenses, which mm-hmm. are the ground-based interceptors that are being installed now in Alaska and in California, as well as the proposed interceptors in Poland, but then also theater missile defenses, which aren't talked about very much, which are like deployed on Aegis cruisers, on ships,
right.
or airborne systems, which are in development, or very speculatively space-based systems. But the point is, with this one of these ships, for example, you sail the ship up to the coast of a country where the U.S. has forward deployed forces, and it serves as a kind of a shield to protect the forces that are operating on the ground. And then the third leg is of this triad is the research and development infrastructure which supports the offenses and the defenses. So this is the system whereby and you look at that system, the importance of the research and development infrastructure is paramount. It's been elevated. And in all of the policy documents and budget requests and planning documents, they talk about this, the importance of this responsive infrastructure, and whether we have one nuclear weapon or 100 or 10,000, we still need the same capabilities to be able to respond to an uncertain future and unknown threats and so on and so forth. That's the military-industrial complex piece that I was talking about that is embedded in that simple sentence, we will, as long as nuclear weapons exist, we will maintain a robust nuclear deterrent.
Right.
So these are really powerful, entrenched institutional interests. And so a nice statement, I will lead the way to a world without nuclear weapons, comes smack up against this entrenched interest and the fact that the nuclear weapons complex is being modernized as we speak, that the existing nuclear weapons, with or without this new one, are being modernized under the so-called Stockpile Life Extension Program and given enhanced military capabilities. And we've got this commitment to maintain the world's most powerful military. So all of this is embedded in this overwhelming conventional military. So it's very sobering, you know. I'm not happy to be giving this bad news.
Well, I agree with you. It's not good news. We do have one caller I want to squeeze in, though, because we are running low on time.
Okay.
So we're going to go to Marilyn, who's on the line. Good morning, Marilyn.
Good Good morning. Yes, I have one question. Who's running the show here?
Oh, go right ahead, Marilyn. You are right now.
Yeah, is the military running the show, or the president's doing what the military wants?
Oh, that's
talking
your question.
About balance of power. Is there any power left in this country after they've looted it and hollowed it out and shipped all the jobs away and stolen all the money? Is there any power left here in this country against our military?
Okay.
Yeah, well, there's us. No, I'm serious. I mean, I'm sort of taking this tone to say this is a good opportunity for some serious reflection on where we're at. Some serious analysis of what needs to be done, and some serious regrouping, you know, and rethinking our approaches to things. So, yes, I do think there's some power, and I think the power is in the people, and we saw that with the election of Obama. That was one of the really encouraging things about his election.
Do you think that was genuine?
I'm sorry?
You think that was genuine?
Yeah, I do.
I do, too.
I do. And there's the sense of the possible, that's real. Something impossible happened. Something that seemed impossible a few years ago happened. As I mentioned earlier, the Soviet Union disappeared overnight. That seemed impossible, but it happened. So it is appropriate to be hopeful about the possibility of change, but we have to make it happen. And I have been working for nuclear abolition for, you know, more than 25 years, but I do not believe that it can be approached anymore, if it ever could, as a single issue, because of all the ways in which it's embedded in this militarism and foreign policy and all the things we've been talking about. So I think we need to really build a new movement around common values, around nonviolence and cooperation and critical thinking. I think there's been a real shortage of critical thinking in about the way we do things, and really looking for ways in which all of these issues intersect and how people with special issue interests like mine can support other people with other special issue interests that, you know, advance our common agenda.
Sure, and we need to get you on mainstream media where, you know, we can have an actual discussion.
Right. Well, that is a problem, but I did an hour on Fox Radio in Delaware this morning before this, so.
Right. Well, Marilyn, your assignment is to begin calling editors and news directors and asking why they aren't bringing voices like Jacqueline to the debate. And
we're going to make a call right now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, and you know, just kind of winding up here, Jacqueline, I recall I was reading your statement that you made, your talk you gave when you received the Peace Prize, and you had a quote about what's a motto around your office that seems very germane, and it's escaping me.
Yes, pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will.
Exactly, that which seems to really be a good slogan to go by.
Yeah.
Well, again, you know, I appreciate you taking the time out this morning. It's obviously an issue that needs to be revisited over and over again, and I certainly agree with you that we need to not just go back and relax now that one big move has been made to change the administration, that we still need to be getting out there and making our voices heard around these issues.
Right, and I really do want to say again, I think we need to be thinking more systematically and more deeply about some of the structural obstacles that we face, or put it the other way, the structural drivers of this system of voracious militarism.
Right.
And, you know, I'm doing some work with Mayors for Peace, which I recommend to people as something you can do in your own local communities to enroll your mayor. And you can get more information at mayorsforpeace.org.
And while we're saying that, I'm going to have to wrap up because we're almost out of time, but is there a contact information if people want to contact you and or find out more about what the work you're doing?
Sure. It's wslfweb.org,
okay.
Our website.
Great.
And,
well, we're going to have to wrap it up. I'm sorry. I wish we had another hour because it's been great and informative, if a little depressing, but... again, we'll just keep the optimism of the will.
Nonviolence is hope. Nonviolence is the belief that change is possible.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Jacqueline, and best of wishes to you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And I'm going to wrap up here because we're almost out of time. This is Dave Mazza. And remember, you can go to the website, KBLO.fm/voicesfromtheedge. If you want to listen more to this program or hear it again, we'll be putting the podcast up a little later on today. Thank you very much, and we'll see you next week. Stand up for your rights.